Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll go to Washington, D.C., where today there are demonstrations in the mall about the tragedy in Darfur. This also coincides with the African Union's deadline for a signing of a treaty. And we'll look into this tragedy, which the United States government has designated a genocide, although little has been done about it, in contrast to the Rwanda genocide, where afterwards it was called a genocide. This time around, they can actually do something, having designated it as a genocide. So we're talking with Dr. James Jennings, who's the founder and president of Conscience International. He's just back from Sudan 10 days ago, where he was distributing aid to Darfur through local NGOs and engaging in dialogue with officials of the central government of Sudan in Khartoum. And we'll be joined from the demonstrations in Washington, D.C. today by Adam Shapiro, a filmmaker and activist who directed and produced a just-released documentary film, Darfur Diaries. And just to preceding this demonstration today on Friday, five members of Congress were among 11 people arrested protesting in front of the Sudanese embassy. So we'll be looking into efforts to raise the awareness and conscience of America in terms of the ongoing genocide in Sudan. Then we'll talk about the latest news from Iraq, given the new prime minister and hopes expressed by Condoleezza Rice, who seems to be more or less getting stuck with this war. She went over there with Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. He sort of took a back seat to her, and we'll look into the deepening quagmire there this month of April. Over 70 Americans have been killed, which is twice the number from last month. And then we'll talk about, then we'll talk about how 18 of America's richest families are behind the repeal of the so-called death tax. We'll be talking with Taylor Lincoln, who is, for the last 3 years, has been looking into this subject of trying to find out a forensic investigation, if you will, of who is behind this effort to repeal the estate tax. And he has discovered that 18 of America's richest families are behind it. And, of course, they have their willing agents in the Congress trying to convince the public that the average citizen is losing their farms and their businesses, when, in fact, there's no evidence of that at all. So let's now begin with the subject of Darfur with Dr. James Jennings, who's the founder and president of Conscience International. He has just been in Sudan, having just returned 10 days ago, and he's was there delivering aid to Darfur, distributing aid through local NGOs and engaging in high-level dialogue with officials of the central government in Khartoum. And also joining us from the demonstration in Washington, D.C. today, is Adam Shapiro, a filmmaker and activist who's directed and just produced and just released documentary Darfur Diaries. Dr. James Jennings, when you met with the officials in Khartoum, obviously today is the deadline that the African Union and the United Nations have issued for some kind of an agreement here between the Sudanese government and the rebels. What was your opinion of the of the honesty of the people you were dealing with, given that it seems to, that the government in Khartoum says one thing, and but the facts on the ground show another, and they do seem to be entirely behind the Janjaweed militias, who they don't seem to be reining in. So is there any sense that there's anybody on the Sudanese side, Sudanese government side, that seems to be have any genuine interest in a settlement?
Well, in fact, I don't believe that I encountered much in the way of dishonesty, but there's a great deal of denial involved with the people in the ruling cliques in the north of Sudan. And it reminded me something of the U.S. Civil War back in the 1860s, where the northerners and southerners were completely blind to the to the appeals or the needs or the claims of the other side, and there's a lot of racism involved. I think that's still the case in Sudan. So from their point of view, it looks like a civil war. From the point of view of on the ground in Darfur, of course, it's ethnic cleansing, which is genocidal in its outcome, if not its intent. I think it's there's a lot of very troubling news today about the whole situation, but there is at least a deadline that's supposed to be today. The Sudan government announced that they would accept the draft agreement on the peace talks in Abuja, Nigeria, with the rebel groups. However, the Justice and Equality Movement, which is the main rebel groups, said that they're not ready to sign the agreement yet.
But isn't it pretty clear that the Sudanese government supply arms, logistics, and helicopters, and they use transport planes to bomb these villages? So clearly there's complicity here, right?
Definitely. That is a fact. It's been established beyond all doubt that the Janjaweed militias were backed by the Sudan military, and I investigated that when we were down in Darfur, and you can see that by the bullet holes in the people's legs and by the kinds of large munitions that they show us that have been dropped from the helicopters and from the planes. Some time back, the Sudan government agreed to rein in the militias, and that has not, in fact, been accomplished universally in either north, south, or central Darfur.
I believe the opposite has happened, has it not, that the refugees who have escaped into Chad and who are supposedly being protected by the African Union, although there's only 7,000 soldiers and they need at least three times that amount even to have any real effort efficacy in protecting people. The long and the short of it is that the Janjaweed are actually inside Chad harassing these people that they've driven out of Sudan.
Yes, and the situation is complicated by the fact that Idris Deby, the dictator in Chad, has been backed and supplied with some weapons by the U.S. government, among others, including the Libyans. And so the situation is complicated by outside interference from Uganda in the south, Eritrea, from Chad in the west, from Libya. Almost all the countries in the region have their finger in the pot, which is, as well as the great powers now, which has complicated the matter tremendously.
And the military dictator in Chad is not very popular with his own people.
They have a rebellion underway, and they were able to fight it back, I think, with the aid of the French military recently. But I don't think that's over. So when you look at the situation, not just in Darfur, but in the entirety of Sudan, you see that it's very tenuous in terms of security. There are numerous rebellions in the east with the Beja Congress, in the south with the Lord's Resistance Army from Uganda, remnants of the SPLA in the south, and then the two rebel groups in Darfur. I think it's really going to be difficult in the coming days. But the most distressing fact was just announced yesterday by the World Food Program in Rome, where they said, we don't have the money. The donor nations have not provided enough money to feed these people, so we have to cut the rations in half from 2,100 kilocalories per person per day to 1,000, a little over 1,000 calories, which is not enough to really live on if you've been driven out of your homes and suffered from violence. That is a distressing situation. You see, the United States spends 10 times the amount every week in Iraq that it spends in 1 year in Darfur.
Well, indeed, I believe the food donors have only delivered a third of what they promised, and what is particularly disgusting, I guess, about this situation is that retroactively, everybody wrung their hands about what happened in Rwanda, and it was declared a genocide retroactively, although many people at the time were trying to get the world's attention. But in this case, Darfur has been declared by the United States government to be a genocide. And although Senators Brownback and Obama have taken the lead on this, it doesn't. I guess the purpose of today's demonstration is to make the American public aware. Adam Shapiro, you're at the demonstrations today. You're also a filmmaker and activist. You directed and produced a just-released documentary, Darfur Diaries. So what is your sense, Adam? Obviously, you're trying to get the public aware of what's going on, and the demonstration today is designed to do that. Is it a case of compassion fatigue on the part of the donor nations?
I think it's a little bit compassion fatigue. I think it's that there's a tremendous crisis throughout Africa, and many in the international community, including those who are trying to help with, you know, from the humanitarian agencies, the scope of problems in Africa today is just so huge, and trying to come up with a strategy for how to deal with all of them, be they due to natural problems, drought and famine, things like that, be they due to man-made problems like we have in Darfur. It's just such a large, Africa is a large place, and the scale of need is so great. And unfortunately, what we're finding is Western countries, and particularly the United States, is more interested in spending money on weapons and weaponry and wars.
And in terms of the politics, there are a number of congressmen and Sheila Jackson Lee were arrested on Friday, and Tom Lantos among them, a Holocaust survivor. Brownback, a conservative Republican, and Barack Obama, a Democrat, have joined. So what's the political push here? Even the president himself appears to be sympathetic, but how can they? How come the richest and most powerful nation in the world can't help these people? I mean, it's both with money and with food and protection.
I think we can help, and I think it's a question of political will. I think it's very convenient and fairly easy for these representatives to make a symbolic act by getting arrested in front of the Sudanese embassy. This has been going on actually for 2 years, where prominent people have been doing that. But in terms of actually being able to help, the United States government can act. When it had the opportunity, Congress did some months ago, to approve just a mere $50 million for the African Union so that it can continue its mission, the Congress refused to pass it, despite having already said that what's going on in Darfur is genocide. So it is a question of political will. The U.S. has also already said it will not send troops to Darfur as part of a peacekeeping mission. That's not the way to build the coalition and get other countries to contribute. The U.S. The president could appoint a special envoy, as he did with former Ambassador John Danforth, to the North-South peace talks. He has refused to do that. And he has refused to call to task the Sudanese government in a meaningful way. He's hosted, the CIA in this country has hosted the top person of the Sudanese National Security Agency to discuss the war on terror, but did not mention at all the state-sponsored terrorism going on in Darfur.
Let me go back to Dr. James Jennings. Why then this rhetorical flourish, but on the ground, nothing much is being done, both in terms of food and protection. I'm trying to figure out what's the motives of General Omar Bashir and these others. I mean, he just got the Iranian supreme leader just said how wonderful he is and how they need to protect what he's trying to do. And Osama bin Laden weighed in, saying the Crusaders are trying to interfere. What's their motive, do you think, here?
Well, unfortunately, I think that President Omar al-Bashir is playing to the gallery, which has been set up over the last number of decades, with a certain kind of Arab nationalism that is passé now, and he's connected to the wrong realities by ejecting or not permitting some of the UN workers to enter into the country or to enter into Darfur. I think he's made a great mistake. Now, you have to understand that all of this is in the background of the Islamic revolution in the Middle East generally, following Khomeini in 79, and in Sudan in 1989, the Islamist government took over. And now the outcome of the war in Darfur is basically Hassan Turabi, who put Omar al-Bashir in power against his old pupil and Muhammad Ali Osman Taha, the vice president, the same. They were both disciples of Turabi, and now the justice and equality movement has spun off from that. So there is the poison of Islamic extremism, and Osama bin Laden is exactly right in saying that that Bush is wrong. Iraq is not the central front in the war on terror, and now it's Sudan. And yet,
there's a lot of hypocrisy in
Washington. There are crocodile tears. Everybody makes professions of interest in the situation in Darfur, and yet, as Mr. Shapiro said, they're not putting the money behind it that they could put for if that were really what they believe, if that were really true.
But Dr. Jennings, the irony is that if bin Laden, you say, is right to say that Iraq's not the central front, the Sudan is, but he's wrong when he says the Crusader armies are in there. The Crusader armies aren't in there. That's the problem, isn't it? We're saying that, I mean, obviously the Americans don't want to go in. They'd rather have an African army in there, but there's no way in the world we can say that we can't pay for an African army.
My own view is to put 20,000 U.S. troops under blue helmets and inject them into that situation in the middle of a two-sided war, at least. It would make it a three-cornered war and not solve the problem, but it would also increase the capability to recruit volunteers for al-Qaeda. And that would be a very big step, and it would create additional problems. Now, the United States is trying two things. One is the diplomatic track, and the other is threats. And I don't know that either will be pursued very effectively by this administration because they have too many things against them, both at home and abroad.
Well, let me ask Adam Shapiro, who the filmmaker whose documentary Darfur Diaries has just been released. What's the problem here, Adam, both in delivering? We know the logistics of delivering food are nightmarish, but what's the problem in terms of protecting these refugees who've fled these horrors and now are being harassed by the same people who've driven them off their land and murdered their kin? So, you know, obviously Americans are not the solution, but as I say, why can't somebody pull together more than 7,000 African troops?
I don't think there is a good explanation as to why this can't be done. I think given the fact that the world is starting to recognize, including the leadership by the U.S. on this point, that this is a genocide that implies a compulsion to act, both in terms of the U.N. charter and also just moral a moral position in the world today, especially after what we've seen just 11 years ago with Rwanda. There is a need, there is it is time to act, and there really is no good reason why the United States, which is taking the lead in some regard, but can't take a bigger step in terms of leading on this issue and committing the resources to stop the genocide. The African Union has been good in that they have expressed an interest in trying, in wanting to work on this issue, to stop the genocide in Darfur, to bring the two sides to the peace negotiations, but it needs help. And when it's come asking for help, it's found the United States and European countries telling them, well, we're sorry, we can't afford to pay for it. This is, again, and I don't think we can take this out of the overall African context in which European and Western powers have been more interested in exploiting the riches of Africa and not as much in helping its own people.
I thank both of you gentlemen for joining us here in Los Angeles, Adam Shapiro, the documentary filmmaker of Darfur Diaries, and Dr. James Jennings, the founder and president of Conscience International. And I guess the reason, as was expressed, that the United States is unable to help these people in Darfur is that they're bogged down and distracted in Iraq. And I'm now speaking with Dr. Juan Cole. He's a professor of modern Middle Eastern and South Asian history at the University of Michigan. He's widely considered one of America's leading scholars on contemporary Iraq and the Middle East. He's the author of Sacred Spaces and Holy War, a definitive examination of the Iraqi Shiites, and his weblog, Informed Comments, at juancole.com. Blog.com is one of the most popular blogs on the web. And Dr. Cole, I mean, just this week, Rumsfeld and Condoleezza Rice made another secret trip to Iraq. And it did seem, actually, from the press conference, that sort of Rumsfeld was kind of surly, and he wasn't as upbeat as he normally is, and he more or less had Condoleezza Rice step up to the mic, and it almost was metaphoric. So that, you know, they cut the State Department out initially after the so-called victory in 03, and dug this huge hole for themselves, the DOD did. And now it seems that Rumsfeld is dumping this in Condoleezza Rice's lap.
Well, there isn't any good military news. What so-called good news there might be is that the Iraqi government is in the process of being formed, and of course the State Department, Condoleezza Rice, Ambassador Khalilzad, all played a role in breaking the logjam. So obviously, if you were going to put any kind of a positive face on this, it's Condi's and not Rumsfeld's.
And this week, needless to say, over 70 Americans were killed. I mean, this month in April, over 70 Americans were killed. Just today, a number of contractors were killed. That's over twice the casualties from last month. And this has happened in spite of a new Iraqi prime minister being finally, after months and months of haggling and United States pressure, to get rid of the other Dawa leader. They've just swapped him with another Dawa leader. Isn't this guy's just another Dawa guy? He was in exile in Syria, I think, wasn't he?
That's right. The new prime minister, Nouri al-Maliki, was for two decades in exile in Damascus. And I have to say that although I have no special information about his activities while he was there, I suspect that if they were closely looked into, they wouldn't be such as would ordinarily win praise from the Bush administration. Yes, actually, there is no new prime minister. There's a prime minister designate. The president, Jalal Talabani, has asked him to form a government. He's now in the process of trying to do so. That requires that he make deals with other parties about who gets what ministry. I think he probably will be able to form a government. He has a month to do so. But I think it will be a very shaky Italian-style government that could fall at any moment. Having him as prime minister ensures that the guerrilla movement, which is mainly Sunni Arabs opposed to a power grab by Kurds and fundamentalist Shiites, would redouble their efforts to overthrow the government.
And what's the relationship between the Dawa and Muqtada Sadr? Because, I mean, here they are telling, both Rumsfeld and Rice are saying, you've got to stop this sectarian violence. We can't have the so-called Iraqi army infiltrated by militias. And we all know the Iraqi army is a joke because it's essentially a Shia Kurd operation. There are virtually no Sunnis in the Iraqi army. And so they're saying, you know, we can't allow this, the military we're building to be taken over by militias. But here's the prime minister designate and his predecessor totally in bed with the most radical militia leader.
Well, yes, there is a tactical political alliance between Muqtada Sadr and his forces and the Dawa Party. In essence, the two are cousins. Dawa follows Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr, a great Shiite clerical thinker and theorist of the Islamic State, who was executed in 1980 by Saddam Hussein, some say with his own hands. And so Dawa is a follower of a member of the Sadr family. That is Muqtada Sadr's uncle and father-in-law.
And that's the mantle that he's assumed.
Well, he's trying to.
Yeah.
But so in any case, that there should be an alliance between Muqtada Sadr, who followed Muqtada's father, Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, and the followers, the Dawa Party, which follows Muhammad Bakr al-Sadr, isn't so strange. I mean, they're not so far apart. And as I said, you can think about them as kind of political cousins. On the other hand, al-Maliki, to be fair, Dawa is not characterized by having a strong militia of its own. And if there were one Shiite religious party that has some respect and some credibility and which could actually go to the other parties and say, cool it with the militia business, it is probably Dawa.
So who's the Shiite group that's out of control? The Badr Brigade?
Well, in the Ministry of Interior, there appear to be a large number of Badr Brigade fighters in the special police commandos.
Is Iran behind that?
Iran trained them, funded them, and still has strong political connections with them.
So, but what's their? In other words, if you had to negotiate with them within the political framework such as it is, who's fronting for them?
Well, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq, which is a major Iraqi political party and which essentially has won the last two elections in Iraq, got control of the Ministry of Interior and sort of brought these Badr Corps guys into it. So a lot of people feel that unless you get Interior out of the hands of the Supreme Council, nothing is going to change in that regard.
So when the head of the Supreme Council, the spiritual head, Sistani, goes on Iraqi television and says we've got to stop this intramural fighting and get rid of these militias, is he serious?
Well, Sistani is not the head of the Supreme Council. He's got a kind of tactical alliance with it. It's headed by Abdulaziz al-Hakim, who has been very vocal about the inadequacy of the American and British troops and the need to deploy Badr to safeguard shrines and Shiites and so forth. So there's a behind-the-scenes dispute going on between Sistani, who I think really does want to see the militias sidelined, and al-Hakim, who's the leader of this political party that's strongly wedded to ensuring that that his militia continues to play a prominent role.
But surely that's bogus, the notion that they need this militia to protect the shrines. I mean, it's true that somebody's been blowing up these shrines, including the Samarra shrine where the 12th Imam disappeared from. And the Iranian leader apparently is a great follower of the 12th Imam. But the long and the short of it is that it seems that the real story, as far as I can tell, Dr. Juan Cole, is that the reason the civil war hasn't broken out into full-scale civil war is that that we're protecting the Shiites, in effect, that we're doing their dirty work by killing the Sunnis.
Well, obviously, there is a kind of alliance between the U.S. military and the Shiites in the sense that the Sunni Arab guerrilla movement would like to kill a lot of the Shiite political parties, party leaders, and the Americans stand in the way. But to be fair, you know, they have this major shrine of Imam Ali, the son-in-law and successor of the Prophet, according to the Shiite branch of religion, which is really quite central to Shiite religious sensibilities. There's another shrine to the Prophet's grandson, Hussein, at Karbala. If the Sunni Arab guerrillas could do to those shrines what they did to the one in Samarra, I think it really would be civil war. Or if they could kill Sistani. And do you really trust the Iraqi army to defend those shrines from the Sunni Arab guerrillas? I mean, are they that competent yet? So the argument that al-Hakim is making is not, in fact, it seems to me, a crazy argument. I don't agree with it, but I wouldn't want to dismiss it. I mean, I think there are real concerns about security. The U.S. military has, by the way, largely withdrawn from those places, so it's not, in fact, protecting them.
Well, I'd heard some analysts remark that the British who are down there in Basra, about 9,000 of them, that they could be toppled by one truck with loudspeakers.
Well, the British are very exposed. The poor guys, they're in charge of four large provinces. Basra alone has 1.5 million people. If angry Shiites ganged up on them, they've admitted that they just have to get on their helicopters and leave.
Mm-hmm. So that could be a portent of what I think is inevitable there, which is the specter of April 75 in Saigon. in this case, the green zone being evacuated. I mean, what's your reading on this, Dr. Cole, in terms of on the one hand, everybody seems to think that the bases in Balad and other places are there for the long haul, but on the other hand, you get the feeling that that the hole just gets deeper. I know the White House have behind the scenes brought in James Baker to try and come up with some new ideas, at the same time defending Rumsfeld for his failed old ideas. So just give us a sense of where you think it's going in terms of whether we're whistling past the graveyard here.
Well, I think the main reason for which the U.S. and British forces haven't simply been asked to leave by the majority of Iraqis is that they are still afraid of the remnants of the Ba'ath and the new jihadi Salafi movements in the Sunni Arab heartland. And in a way, you know, the more successful the U.S. was in damping down that guerrilla movement, the more bold the rest of the Iraqis would come about become about not needing the U.S. anymore. Personally, I think it's all over with the shouting. That is to say, at some point in the next few years, I think the Iraqis will demand that the U.S. and Britain leave. I don't think there's any prospect of long-term U.S. bases in Iraq. We saw in the Philippines how if the political class in a country wants the U.S. bases out, they can force it. And the U.S. doesn't normally keep bases in a place where the government has asked them to leave. The military has to harden its bases to have them operate efficiently. And there may be people in the Pentagon who would like to keep the bases in the long term, but I don't think they're going to be able to. The real issue is whether security can be restored in Iraq. I don't think the U.S. forces at the moment are actually restoring security. We haven't seen any evidence of security increasing. In fact, things are worse now than they were a year ago. And the U.S. military is mainly involved in search and destroy missions in Sunni Arab areas, which just alienate more and more Sunni Arabs and have them join the resistance.
And Zarqawi, the leader at least the alleged leader of the Salafis, I guess you call them, the Wahhabists,
the Sunni revivalists, you might
right.
say.
He showed himself shooting a machine gun and making all kinds of threats. But the long and the short of it is that these guys have had the initiative. It seems. I mean, I think we won the war on April the 10th of 03 and lost it about April the 15th. So the insurgents have had the initiative ever since, it seems.
Yeah, well, the guerrilla insurgency is mainly Iraqis, and I think it's mainly people with old Ba'ath training and ties, although there are Sunni revivalists amongst it. The foreign jihadis like Zarqawi are a small group, relatively speaking, although they make a lot of noise. But the fact is that if what the U.S. wanted to do was to rebuild Iraq and sort of install a friendly government there, the Sunni Arab guerrilla movement has discovered that that's a fairly easy thing to forestall simply by acting as a spoiler. So anything the U.S. does can be spoiled fairly easily with some bombs and sabotage and so forth. And that's why the U.S. is in essence losing. If you're not winning a guerrilla war, you're losing it. The guerrillas can spoil with relatively low-tech bombs and with sabotage that's relatively easy to pull off. And the U.S. has no tools to stop that. It does. Most of the U.S. military doesn't even know Arabic. They can't do good surveillance. They don't know who the guerrillas are. So the U.S. is losing in that sense.
But surely the other side of it, Dr. Cole, is the fact that whatever political front we've tried to put in there has been totally corrupt and incompetent. And maybe that's just philosophical. I mean, after all, the Bush administration here at home have essentially turned over the government treasury to their cronies. So, surprise, surprise, the same thing's happening in Iraq.
Well, you know, the Iraqi political class that's now in power has no experience of governing. they were exiles in London and Tehran. They were physicians and political apparatchiks. They don't know how to run anything. There's nobody in the Iraqi government who has any substantial experience about how to form a bureaucracy, how to get middle managers on board with policy, how to make sure policy is implemented efficiently. They don't know how to do that. And then the U.S. in its wisdom just dissolved its army, so they don't even have a military that they can command to go and do something and be sure the military will do it. And it takes 5, 7, 10 years to build a new military. So at the moment, the Iraqi government is A, inexperienced, and B, toothless. And, of course, well, there's issues of corruption and so forth. But I really think that that the inexperience and the toothlessness are more important in the fiasco.
Well, I think the corruption would largely, you'd have to blame our side, because time and time again you hear reports of that money has been allocated for schools and pipeline repair, et cetera, and it's been spent, but there are no results.
Well, there are results. There just aren't as many results as one would have hoped for. Yeah. In some
something instance. Like 20% or
yes.
About
well,
a, yeah.
They faced a lot of sabotage, and they've had to divert a lot of money to security. I mean, it's one thing to say you want to build a school. It's another thing to have to hire a lot of people to guard the workers while they're building the school so they're not just shot down. And, of course, the vast insecurity in the country has made it very difficult for civilian contractors to operate. So the guerrillas have spoiled this rebuilding effort. I mean, there was corruption and on a massive scale, but I think most of the reason for which things didn't get done has to do with sabotage.
And now the latest figures from the Congressional Research Office are $811 billion and counting for Iraq. So
I think actually what they're saying is that it's about half that so far, but they expect it soon to double.
Right.
Well, we're going towards $1 trillion as an expenditure on the Iraq enterprise. The American people have to decide whether that's how they want to spend their money.
Right. And then the State Department just came out with its report on terrorism, saying that's now Iraq is now the kind of hub of world terrorism. In effect, it seems this blunder in Iraq has moved al-Qaeda 1,000 miles closer to Europe. And apart from the $1 trillion price tab, we've not got any oil. If that was the motive, it hasn't materialized. I mean, there's not much you can say that's been achieved here except pain, suffering, and waste of resources.
Yes, I mean, the one thing that...
And a tremendous geopolitical victory for Iran.
Yes. No, the whole thing has clearly been one of the great foreign policy debacle in American history. We've destabilized the eastern reaches of the Middle East. The whole idea that after September 11th was a good time for the United States to try to occupy an Arab-Muslim country militarily... was always stupid, and it has stirred up a lot of trouble. I mean, the Madrid bombings, the London bombings are directly tied to the Iraq situation, and if this was in any way done for U.S. national security, then it has backfired on a grand scale. And it's not just that Iraq itself has become a base of operation for terrorism, but it inspires people all over the world, and not just Muslims, to hatred of the United States. There's these sort of search and destroy missions that they do against the guerrillas inevitably kill ordinary civilians. And, after the U.S. destroyed Fallujah, more or less, and engaged in torture at Abu Ghraib and so forth, the U.S., you know, used to have actually some moral authority. And I think that's been destroyed for a generation.
Well, just in closing, though, you're suggesting, Dr. Cole, that we could probably hang on to this agony, even though it's not going to get any better. We're just going to be sort of hanging on because nobody has the political courage, it seems, to recognize that this is a hopeless situation and that every day that passes, it gets worse. But if we do go in militarily against Iran, I should say, surely that will accelerate the debacle, won't it?
Well, if we went in militarily against Iran, Iraq would explode. The Shiite Iraqis would turn against us to a man, and there would be hell to pay. And, of course, Iran has allies like Hezbollah in southern Lebanon that can activate terrorist networks. So the price that the U.S. would pay for a direct attack on Iran would be enormous. And, of course, there is also a danger of throwing the whole region into a regional guerrilla war. We could see petroleum prices go up 10 times to what they are now. And so it's a very dangerous situation. The U.S. doesn't really have the military capability of doing something with its army against Iran. But if it were to bomb Iran, I think there would be a very bad reaction.
Or if the Israelis were to bomb Iran.
Yeah.
It's the same. It would be the same. Now, just in closing, but on that subject of the Israeli lobby, the article that got so much attention, you wrote a piece recently in Salon. I actually know Meir Shimer too, and he's an extremely studious guy, and certainly in no way anti-Semitic. But it seems the reaction to this whole article that was published and that has been basically vilified and not being covered, it's almost a test case of the thesis that they are presenting, which is if you screw with the Israeli lobby, you're history.
Yeah, well, it's very unfortunate that, you know, there is an Israel lobby. The American Public Affairs
APAC
is enormously powerful in Congress. It's not all powerful, but everybody knows that it has a lot of clout. And it certainly has had an influence on American policy in the region.
Yeah, but the point is, Juan, you can't talk about it.
Yeah, to say that somebody who says that is therefore a racist bigot,
right,
is profoundly anti-democratic. I mean, we have to be able to discuss these things. I actually have started a petition among academics to defend Mearsheimer and Walt from this calumny, and we addressed the petition to the Conference of Presidents of Major American Jewish Organizations.
But you yourself have now, the neocons are coming after you, trying to stop you to get an appointment at Yale, right?
Well, universities still have a great deal of integrity, and we don't usually make our decisions about these things based upon what pundits and yellow journalists have to say about these things.
Well, I wish you luck with your petition, and I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Dr. Juan Cole, who's the country's leading authority on contemporary Iraq. I'm now speaking with Taylor Lincoln, who's a former newspaper reporter. He has a master's in journalism from the University of Maryland, and he has worked for the last 3 years at Public Citizens Congress Watch, where he is the research director. He's the co-author of a new report entitled Spending Millions to Save Billions, which looks into the financial interests behind the repeal of the estate tax, which I believe, Taylor, 18 of America's richest families are behind the repeal of this so-called death tax.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me. Yes, what we were able to do is comb through records, whether they be lobbying disclosure records or anecdotal reports about the contributions to grassroots advertising campaigns, and identify 18 families that have contributed to the campaign to repeal the estate tax. And specifically among these 18 families, each one either has confirmed assets in excess of $100 million, or we're almost sure that they do have assets in excess of $100 million. We just couldn't find a number. For instance, the Wegman families that owns a string of gourmet grocery stores around the country is one of the two that we couldn't get that figure on. But these are mega millionaire and billionaire families who have been waging a campaign to repeal the estate tax.
And so you've got the Walmart people, you've got the Mars candy people. Who else have you got?
We've got the Waltons of Arkansas, and as you mentioned, they do own a family business called Walmart. There is the Mars candy people. The Gallo family out in California owns the Gallo wineries. The Dorrance family owns a 40% interest in Campbell Soup, a billionaire family that many people may not be familiar with, but they're from California, so your listeners may, is the Sobrato family.
What do they own, and what's their company?
Real estate. There's the DeVos family of Michigan, which owns half of Amway, the multi-level marketing pioneer firm. So that gives you a sense.
So tell me about how these wealthy families have gotten their political agents to con the American people into believing that repealing the estate tax, which they've labeled rather cleverly the death tax, is going to help them. We all know that there's not one iota of evidence that any family farm has been lost due to the so-called death tax. They've already raised the ceiling on it at any rate. I think you can write up $1.3 million or something.
No, it's up to $2 million. It's $4 million a couple.
$2 million. Well, goes
$3.5 million in 2009 and $7 million
right.
a couple.
And so really, let's face it. That's a pretty high threshold. So
it's more. I don't mean to like be overly personal about my finances, but it's more than I've got.
Right. So we know it's a bogus issue. So
yeah.
Then, how did they? Who are these political whores that are selling this nonsense to the gullible American people?
Yes. And do you want the technicals in terms of the kind of groups and lobbyists that they employed, or the message? I think the message is more interesting.
Okay, well, tell me that.
The message is, it's right out of the playbook of Frank Luntz, who's the Republican pollster and sort of language guru who knows how to put out a message and sell it to the public. He sold us a lot of bridges so far. And it was Luntz who either originated or decided to flog heavily the term death tax versus estate tax to give the thing a negative connotation. And they came up with a bunch of other messages, which sound great at the outset. They're phony when you look at them. One is double tax. You worked hard all your life. You paid taxes when you made the money. Now you're going to pay the tax again. Problem is that these folks don't really go to work like you and I do, where they get a paycheck every 2 weeks and a W-2 at the end of the year. Their assets are held primarily in property and stock in the form of unrealized capital gains. So they've never paid taxes on most of their assets. But that point resonates with the American people. Another is it's an immoral tax. It's a tax on hard work. You worked hard all your life. You were thrifty. You saved, and now the government's going to come in and punish you. And the problem there is, of the 18 families that we identified, it gets a little dicey how you calculate exactly, but basically 14 or 15 of them, the wealth is not in the first generation of that family, which is to say these kids inherited this money. They didn't get rich by hard work. They got rich by getting born.
Right. Well, this is clearly the Bush administration exemplifies a government of inheritors and investors. But again, I'm curious to Taylor Lincoln as to what do the Frank Luntzes and these Republicans who are carrying water for the ultra rich, what do they get out of it?
I think it's to fire up the base. You know, they get so much energy. There's, you know, the two wings of the Republican Party. You got the economic sort of libertarian wing,
right,
and you got the religious conservatives.
Right.
And this would go to the economic side, but it also plays great in the South with the religious conservatives. It resonates. And I think it's a fire up the troops issue. You know, they love to, you take somebody like Governor Norquist, who's right in the middle of this thing.
Right.
He's never seen a tax cut he doesn't like, right? This one wouldn't necessarily be the first one that a lot of people would go for, and in fact, it was kind of people who have studied this have said it was a real long-shot campaign, because even among tax cutters, this wasn't their first choice, but the movement got started in large part to somebody right around the part of the country where you're, and it's a lobbyist named Patricia Soldano in Orange County, California, and she was representing these type of families. She had at least seven of the families that we mentioned in our report as clients. And we know what their motives are.
Right.
They want to protect their billions. But she got the message out and went in with Frank Luntz, and they started talking about this stuff, that it's an immoral tax, it's the wrong tax. And, you know, there's other stuff we can go into. I mean, there's some stuff that they said that was outright fraudulent and intellectually dishonest. Like, they said that it cost the government more money to bring in the tax than it brings in, which is not even close. I mean, it's just an outright lie. And so they got popular appeal for this thing. And I think what happened for the Republican Party is it's like you got somebody like George Bush. He's like, what sells?
Uh-huh.
And this thing sells like crazy. You know, and I forgot in ticking off my points, the one thing that you mentioned at the beginning, the whole family farm small business thing. I mean, that's the other thing. And so they had a winner. And I think that they've just kind of all decided we're going to go with our...
But it's a lie. I mean, it's a complete lie. But
yep.
So what does this say about the people in the red states and these good Christians down in the South? They're getting all fired up to protect the ultra rich. I mean, and they're doing it in the name of the Lord Jesus, who ministered to the poor.
Right. Well, you know, it's I guess I'd say in defense of folks, I mean, it's complicated stuff, and they're not getting any help from first of all, the people that are hearing these TV ads. On the whole, they're probably not as well educated. They're certainly not as rich, and they are absolutely certainly not as familiar with the issues as these families that are paying for these TV ads that mislead them. And, you know, the one thing is when you see these TV ads saying if you die, the government can come in and take everything you've got, and they've said that. I mean, under no reading can the government take everything you've got. You know, worst case scenario, it's 55%. Above $1 million or $2 million. Congress is so messed up, the exemption amount keeps going up and down. But they'll say the government come in and take everything you've got, and there's no caption in the ads that says applies to people with more than $2 million in assets, applies to couples with more than $4 million in assets, or that 1/4 of 1% of all Americans are going to have to pay this. And I did a TV piece this week on CNBC on this report. Driver picked me up, and I went and told her what I was going to go on about. And she said, well, that's interesting, because most of the people I know thought that if you die and you've got $10,000, the government's going to come in and take half. And then I said, well, what do you think? And she says, well, I never knew. It's confusing. So, you know, it'd be nice if people knew better, but they're not getting any help.
So, in other words,
really, because this is a fraudulent campaign. I mean, this is a campaign that's predicated on deceiving people.
But I just want to know whether you know, I know you're not a pollster, but I thought that this country was, in many ways, was founded on individualism and that there was a sense of egalitarianism in the whole American experience. And this story that you're telling us here today, to me, represents a country of pathetic, wealth worshipping sheep. You know, this is worse than those people who allow Donald Trump to humiliate them.
Yeah, you know, I think things have changed. I mean, the movement for the estate tax, its origins, early 20th century. Teddy Roosevelt thought, you know, it was against the concentration of wealth. Andrew Carnegie, you know, one of the great tycoons, thought it wasn't healthy for small amounts of people to accumulate large amounts of wealth. That was then. You know, I don't think the country does think that way anymore. And, you know, one of the big things is, let's face it, there is a huge backlash against government. You talk about the red states all hate government. And the challenge that I always pose to the people, on the rare chance that I get to debate the pro-repeal people, the anti-estate tax people, is to say, hey, look, forgetting whether the estate tax is a good or bad tax compared to other taxes, we're running a $400 billion deficit right now that we're passing on to our kids. That's something they're also going to inherit. Whether or not you get rid of the estate tax, they're going to be paying taxes to service this debt. And the question is, what's your answer? If you want to take this tax off the book, what's your answer to clean things up so that we're not running bigger deficits? And I don't think that they've presented that. They've said this is the wrong tax. I don't think they've said what the right tax is.
But the bottom line is, in the last, certainly since George Bush has become president, it's accelerated, but this is a trend that's been going on for some time, that the rich are getting richer,
yep,
and the poor are getting poorer and more numerous.
Yep.
And this is the reality of America. So who is going to advocate some fairness here? And in the name of what I thought this country stood for, I didn't think we were a bunch of pathetic minions of the wealthy.
Get your listeners turned around, Ian. Get them fired up.
Well, but you're suggesting that there's no political opposition that's putting out your message. In other words, where are the Democrats on this?
Well, the Democrats, I think, the fact of the matter is, the other side, even though the tax only affects 1/4 of 1% of all people, the other side has succeeded in demonizing the estate tax. We'll see what happens. We'll see if our report helps. Bill Frist promised to bring this to the Senate floor. I think he's done that as a sop to his conservative brethren to build support for his presidential campaign. And we'll see what the Democrats use the information in this report to go to the floor with it. I think that so far what the Democrats have said on, they've tiptoed lightly on this because they've been getting hit hard by some of these 527 groups and other nonprofit groups that have been running ads attacking them for not favoring a repeal of the estate tax. I think so far they sort of tiptoed lightly and said, I'm for modifying it, I'm for raising the exemption level, we can't afford it. I don't think that we've quite seen any Democrat come out and say, hey, it's just a plain old good tax in the name of an egalitarian structure. I haven't heard that kind of courage.
Well, it's pretty clear that, 18 families,
Right. Now, to be fair, there's others.
Oh, there are others, but at least
you're able to identify. But the thing is the more we could identify others, we're going to find more of the same. You know, I'm convinced of that. Mm-hmm. The Patricia Saldano, about whom we were able to learn through sort of a momentary lapse where she was forthcoming in her lobbying disclosure forms, which she ceased to be, federal lobbying disclosure submissions. She said she's got 65 clients, I believe 60 or 65 clients in 25 states, and those clients aren't like you and me, you know? I mean, these clients have a dog in this fight, and in most cases, they're probably not just millionaires. They don't have $2 million or $3 million. These are a whole new class of wealth, which is mega millions, you know, probably at least tens of millions, and in most cases, hundreds of millions or billions of dollars.
And they're getting good value. You hire a lobbyist and get the dumb American taxpayer, voter, to give you a free pass so you can make zillions more. It's an amazing.
Well, yeah, I mean, we figured.
I'd love to get into that business. We've run out of time. Okay. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining us, Taylor.
Ian, thanks so much for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again. I was just speaking then with Taylor Lincoln, who has worked for the last 3 years at Public Citizens Congress Watch, where he's research director on this report, Spending Millions to Save Billions. I thank Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Jazz Shepherd, the engineer, Rusty Wynn, the associate producer, Carol Coote, the assistant producer.